Welcome back to Therapy Insiders. Dr. Gene Sciroccarod here with Dr. Joe Palmer. And today we have a very special episode for you guys. We have a very special guest, Dr. Jan Dahmerholt. And I can list his whole resume, but that might be a show in itself, so I'll spare you that. You can check him out, Maya Pain Seminars. We're going to talk about dry needling today. We'll dabble with some other topics, but that is going to be our main focus today. So Jan, welcome to the show. Nice to have you.
Thank you for having me.
So Joe, I know I've taken some of Jan's courses. I know you've been interested in dry needling. Dry needling's been around for a little while, but it's only picking up steam now, seems like. So first question, Jan, why don't you tell us what dry needling is? Why is it dry? What kind of needles? What is it for people that have no idea what dry needling is, just heard the term? What really is it?
Well, within the context of physical therapy, dry needling developed out of the work of Dr. Janet Travell and David Simons. And although they never did dry needling, they used injection techniques to treat myofascial trigger points. And early on in Travell's career, in the early 1940s, someone actually told her and published that subsequently, that they thought that the effect of the injection was actually the needle itself and not what was being injected. That kind of lost ground, and not till the late 1970s, actually someone in the Czech Republic, at that point Czechoslovakia, put the test, started testing this and published a paper on a technique called dry needling. So basically this was a technique similar to the injection therapy, using a solid filament needle to treat myofascial trigger points.
So it's been around since the 70s, you can say?
It's really been around since the late 70s, yes. Okay. There were two papers published almost simultaneously, one from the Czech Republic and published in the journal Pain, and another paper coming from Vancouver, Canada, which was published the next year in 1980.
So you're dry needling trigger points, and we'll get into trigger points in a little bit. But before even getting into that, probably the most common question I get, and I'm sure you do as well, is, isn't this acupuncture?
That's a good question and a controversial question, if I may add. From the perspective of many acupuncturists, this is strictly acupuncture and nothing else. Yet dry needling is used in many, many disciplines, not only physical therapy, not only acupuncture, but also in veterinary medicine, in dentistry, in regular medicine, chiropractic. Some countries even allow massage therapists to use dry needling, such in Australia, where there's a technique called, often the school called myotherapist, and they also do dry needling. So we use the same tool as an acupuncturist, and dry needling certainly is in the scope of acupuncture practice, but I do not believe that it is in the exclusive scope of acupuncture practice. And that would actually be a bad thing if techniques are in the exclusive scope of any kind of practice, any discipline.
So how would you describe the difference, if you had to say the difference between acupuncture and dry needling? And obviously, we're not speaking for the acupuncturist, but we just want to outline the clear difference, or if you had to tell a patient the difference between the two.
It depends a little bit on what kind of acupuncture you are referring to. There are, in China, over 80 different schools of acupuncture. Worldwide, there are hundreds of different schools of acupuncture. Even within the United States, there are a school in Maryland is not the same as a school in New York or a school in Colorado. They have different perspectives, different backgrounds. Some schools follow the more traditional Chinese philosophies. Others do Japanese acupuncture. Others have Vietnamese acupuncture or French-Vietnamese acupuncture. There's an American school of acupuncture. And each of these schools have different ideas about what they do. In the traditional Chinese acupuncture world, the emphasis is on energy disturbances and meridians and channels. On the extreme end of that is the modern Western acupuncture that is practiced by many physicians and also non-physicians, where meridians are kind of irrelevant and people really don't look at that. So it depends a little bit on what school of acupuncture you're talking about. It's kind of like saying, I have a car and I want you to know what kind of car I have. If you say I do acupuncture, there are so many different kinds of acupuncture that it's difficult to make a general statement. There are acupuncturists who do techniques very similar to dry needling. If I asked an acupuncturist, could you treat a patient, or how would you treat a patient with a trigger point in the anterior serratus anterior muscle, I'm not sure that many acupuncturists could answer that. That acupuncturist was asked me, how would you treat someone with a kidney deficiency? I would be just as stumped and have no idea what to do with that.
So that's a good point. I agree with you. I think there is a clear benefit to both. I have plenty of patients that go to acupuncture and I recommend it as an adjunct to therapy and dry needling, and they respond really well, and vice versa. But you mentioned meridian points and energy. Does dry needling involve any of those components?
The school of dry needling that I propose does not have anything in common with that.
So how do you treat with dry needling? What are you looking for?
For dry needling, the first thing I look for is basically how does the patient move, what is their posture, which part of muscles are likely to be overloaded. So there's a mechanical part, a motor part to the picture, and there's also a sensory part going by what the patient tells me the areas of pain. If someone has temporal headaches and pain behind their eye, I look for those muscles that would refer pain in those regions, so-called referred pain. And so both the motor aspect and the sensory aspect determine where I would look in the first place. That patient with the headaches, I may look at the sternocleidomastoid, a big muscle in the neck. I may look at some of the cervical muscles in the back of the neck, as all these muscles are known and have been proven to relate to migraine and tension type headaches.
And are there any contraindications to dry needling when you're looking at these symptoms?
There are not many contraindications. And then rather than contraindications, we usually prefer the term precautions. Because there are very few real contraindications. If a patient is
Okay.
terribly afraid of needles, I would call that a contraindication. If someone not able to give consent because they can't communicate you because of cognitive factors, I would not do that. If someone has open wounds, I would not use a needle in that area, no matter how much pain they would have. But these are fairly extreme examples. Most people may have relative precautions where you need to be a little bit more careful. Abnormal bleeding tendency is one of those. If people are on blood thinners, that doesn't mean you can't do dry needling, but you need to be aware of that. And certainly, once the needle is removed from the tissue, you need to apply hemostasis or direct pressure on the area to make sure that there's no later bleeding. But there are not real contraindications, that they're mostly precautions.
So even though there aren't contraindications, they're precautions, that doesn't mean you can just, anybody can dry needle or you can be lax. Aside from in-depth anatomical knowledge, you have to know some physiology as well. So once that needle goes in, what are you actually trying to do with it? And what's going to happen after you hit that trigger point that you mentioned?
Well, the first thing, the most important thing in dry needling is actually palpation. And sometimes people who do not know much about dry needling say that we are afraid of touching patients because we use a needle instead. Well, that is far from the truth. The most important thing is actually palpating the involved musculature, finding a contracture, which feels like almost like a ropey tissue within the muscle. You go along that ropey tissue, which in the trigger point world is referred to as a taut band. And once you find the taut band, you go along the taut band, and there's usually one or two areas of more extreme contraction. And that usually is very tender to palpation, and that's what's referred to as a trigger point. The needle is placed directly over this into the skin, overlying the trigger point, and the needle is moved forward till you, with a fair amount of speed, till you hit that trigger point. And what that happens then is a fairly unique phenomenon because the contraction band, or the contracture, the taut band, will actually very quickly contract before it lets go, before it releases. That contracture, that quick contraction, is called a local Twitch response, and that's been shown to be directly related to the success of the therapy. Unfortunately, that's the part that patients typically don't like as much, but from a therapeutic perspective, that is one of the things we try to accomplish.
So, tell us a little bit about MyoPain and your educational courses that you are involved with right now.
Well, Myo Pain Seminars is a course program that we founded several years ago. Officially, it actually didn't start till 2007. But before that, we already taught dry needling courses for many years. We started teaching dry needling courses in Europe. Our first course series were in Spain, actually. That was in 1996. 1996, no one did dry needling in Spain. And we were really the first to introduce this. Currently, there are over 4,000 physical therapists in Spain who use the form of dry needling in their practice. So that has grown very, very fast. In 1997 is when we first taught the dry needling courses in the United States. Excuse me?
Do you see the same kind of a uptick in usage here in the United States?
Well, initially it was fairly slow. We were the only program that taught dry needling programs. The course is still actually quite a few years. Right now, and at that point in 1984 was when Maryland, the state of Maryland, was the first state to approve dry needling for physical therapists. Right now, there are 31 or 32 states that have approved it. So yes, there is definitely a very fast growth at the moment.
And so I was looking at there seems like there's constant battles as far as regulations and proposed regulations for trying to standardize education for dry needling. When it's all said and done, where do you think the training and the classes will settle down?
That's an interesting question. I see many parallels with the development of using manipulation in physical therapy. When that was first introduced, there was much resistance, not only from therapists themselves, but also from other professions, chiropractic profession, some other allopathic physicians. Even the American Physical Therapy Association was not very fond of the thought of manipulation. Dry needling has followed a fairly similar development. Although we started teaching dry needling in the United States in 1997, it was not till 2009 that the American Academy of Orthopedic Manual Physical Therapists acknowledged that dry needling is actually in the scope of physical therapy practice. A year later, the American Physical Therapy Association recognized dry needling as an official part of the profession of physical therapy. And in 2012 and 2013, the American Physical Therapy Association actually published several resource guides about dry needling. And this is an interesting question, because how does this need to be regulated? At this point, the American Physical Therapy Association has some guidelines regarding the background of dry needling, but the regulation is done at the state level. And some states have taken that more serious than others. Some states have said, yes, it is in the scope of practice, or even more lax, there is nothing in the scope in the Practice Act that prohibits you from using dry needling. Whereas other states have taken a more thorough look at this and actually have come up with regulations. The states that do not have regulations very commonly today are being challenged by acupuncture societies and acupuncture boards with the belief that physical therapists should not be allowed to do this at all, because they believe that it's the sole practice of acupuncture.
Well, dry needling is unique on several levels. The biggest one being that it's an intramuscular technique. You're actually putting a needle in. Now, we have EMG testing that PTs can do. I think some people don't even know that. So we're on the kind of that same wavelength. So kind of safe to say that people a lot are afraid of the unknown. So hopefully we can educate them on the known. And we are usually described as the musculoskeletal experts. We're movement experts. And dry needling is effective in treating myofascial pain, but what is the end goal? I know you treat a lot of patients in your Bethesda clinic, and dry needling helps with pain, but what else can it help with in terms of overall health, healing, and return to function?
Well, there's two aspects I'd like to comment on. Let me start with the second part of your question first, and then go back to the beginning of your statement.
Sure.
The effect of dry needling are multiple ways. First of all, it's a very effective way to reduce pain or eliminate pain. I mentioned headaches, but it's been used for low back pain, for migraines, tension-type headaches, carpal tunnel syndrome, pain after mastectomy surgery. And there's research studies on all these topics. So dry needling is very effective in reducing pain. Dry needling is also very effective in improving range of motion. So when, let's say, an athlete, let's say a tennis player, has limited ability to get the full swing in their arm when they serve a ball or hit a ball, and dry needling can actually improve the efficiency of the movements of the and even the power of the hit. In fact, the professional tennis elite recognized the benefits of dry needling, and both the Association of Tennis Professionals and the Women's Tennis Association have recruited myopain seminars to teach their physical therapists how to do dry needling on the absolute tennis elites.
Can you elaborate on that?
Dry needling does a lot more than just deal with pain.
You said that it improves the strength and the function. How so? How does it improve after you dry needle, let's say, those tennis players?
By restoring the muscle length, when the muscles have the contractures of the toroid bands in them, you are automatically weaker. The muscle cannot generate its full strength, and patients often, or athletes often, feel weaker than they should be. As soon as you release the trigger point, strength almost always returns to full within minutes after the dry needling. So that goes very, very fast. Now, what the exact mechanism of that is still not known.
And so what about carryover, Jan? How long do results typically last?
I would say that depends a little bit on how long people have had problems. For many really acute problems, you only need one or two or three treatments. For more chronic problems, like a real frozen shoulder, that can take a lot longer. But most patients really don't need that much dry needling before they can start doing more functional training and exercise and strengthening and stretching exercises. For many patients, the dry needling is used in the beginning of their therapy program, and very quickly they switch over to more traditional forms of physical therapy with exercise and strengthening, stretching, etc.
Now, you mentioned dry needling therapy. Not many therapists probably just solely do dry needling. So it's in my practice, you know, I use dry needling. It's quite effective, but there's also other aspects. There's usually causes to the myofascial pain. There's causes to the trigger points.
Absolutely.
And it becomes a chicken or the egg type of thing. So, and you and I have had a brief discussion about this in the past. And, you know, I do joint manipulations when joints send the aberrant inputs to the tissues of that segment that's dysfunctional. It can cause those dysfunctions. But when muscle is hypertonic, when muscle is tender to palpation and touch, sometimes you can't get to the joint to fix it. And I found dry needling to be quite effective at reducing that tenacity and that pain, so I could get to the next step. And you do the manipulation, and again, you can look at other segments, fix the muscles, and then once that length and tension is restored, then you get into your functional restoration, your neuro re-add, your PNF, whatever else you want to do. And like you said, it's been pretty effective for athletes.
Yeah, and this actually, the question is also, should you manipulate or should you do dry needling? That really is not an either-or question. They really go hand in hand. There are a few scientific studies that have looked at that, and manipulation of C3, of the cervical spine, for example, does lead to a reduction of pressure tenderness in trigger points in the trapezius muscle, which has a C3 innervation. And some other people have done facet blocks at C5 in the cervical spine, and that actually reduced the sensitivity of trigger points in the infraspinatus. And vice versa, that is true as well. If you treat the trigger point, the sensitivity in the facet joints will be less, and mobility will automatically improve. So they really go hand in hand. And dry needling is really not a standalone therapy. It's always, you mentioned, you need to look at causes. If someone has forward head posture, which the majority of our pain patients do have, you can do all the needling you want, you can do all the manipulations you want, but if there's no educational component and a training component to work on the forward head posture and correct that and give people the tools to function in a more efficient way, it will not be effective. It is just one small part of a possible physical therapy regimen.
I wholeheartedly agree. I that's one of my pet peeves when talking to fellow colleagues and other clinicians, is when people start talking about this or that, which technique is best. And I just kind of, you know, shake my head and say, why do you pick a technique? Why does it have to be this or that? Why does it have to be manual therapy? Why does it have to be just exercise? Patients benefit from everything. We're not simple individuals. We got to look at everything. We got to look at motion. We got to look at pain generators, and we got to find the cause. And I know Joe can elaborate on this as well. We see a good bit of quote unquote chronic pain patients, but to me, a lot of times it's not chronic pain. It's just people that have been in pain for X amount of time that just haven't had the proper treatments. I'm sure you've had a few of those, Joe, right?
Absolutely. And Jan, this is kind of a way that you use needling as a technique to break that pain cycle. Is that correct?
That is exactly correct. Yeah, I look at dry needling really as an instrument-assisted manual therapy. And it's just another technique in manual therapy. Dry needling in itself is not a discipline. It is not something that should be compared to disciplines. That happens a little bit in the acupuncture world, where they say, you know, dry needling must be a public health hazard. And people actually claim that it is a public health hazard because physical therapists learn dry needling techniques in a couple of weekend courses. And that is often contrasted with acupuncturists who have 2,500 hours of education. But when you make that comparison, you're really not being fair, because the comparison now is between a discipline and a technique. If you look at the entire education of physical therapy, physical therapists on average have an education of 2,676 hours, which is very comparable and often exceeds acupuncture education. And it's not comparing which one is better or not, but if you compare disciplines to disciplines, I would argue that both disciplines are perfectly capable of using that little needle. The dry needling techniques are fairly simple. So the argument that this would be a public health hazard really does not hold up. In fact, we just got a paper accepted, a study that will be in the Journal of Manual Manipulative Therapy. It should come out any day now, of nearly 8,000 treatments by physical therapists using dry needling. This is a study conducted in Ireland, where we teach courses as well. And in many of our graduates of the course program participated in this study. And the risk of a significant adverse event, and the worst thing that could happen is probably pneumothorax, a collapsed lung, which did not happen in any of the almost 8,000 treatments. The risk of a significant adverse event was 0.04%. That is not nothing, it's not zero, but it is so tiny that in the hands of a qualified physical therapist, dry needling is extremely safe. To put it in context, the risk of taking aspirin and then it's causing a significant adverse event is about 18%, 1/8 versus 0.04 for dry needling. So, you know, it is an assisted manual therapy that in the hands of physical therapists in anatomy, in physiology, and hopefully in pain sciences. Those are the components that make for a very efficient clinician.
Now, you mentioned when we started talking, Janet Travell. Dr. Travell, I know her from referral pathways. I know she has her book on trigger points. I found dry needling extremely effective in that respect. When I have patients come in describing symptoms that typically don't really add up. But if you understand referral patterns, they become quite clear. And I understand this is the referral and all that is somewhat controversial. But in my experience, and you can chime in as well, if you really study these referral patterns, and they're not always present, you can have latent trigger points as well, is when that needle and the contraction happens, patients a lot of times have the reproduction of that referral pain. So a lot of times if you're needling the cervical musculature, you'll elicit a headache. Or if you're needling the gluteals, you'll have a referral in the leg. Do you find that commonly as well?
Yeah, that is very common. And I think in that sense, Travell really made a unique contribution to the world of medicine and in general in the world of pain sciences, although she really did not consider it to be pain sciences. I don't think that term was even invented yet. When Travell started pain, which piqued her interest, and then when she started reading and more looking into that, she realized that all muscles have fairly specific referred pain patterns. We translate that to today's world because, frankly, Travell's books are kind of outdated by now. The referred pain patterns are very well described. But the last version of the book was published in 1999, and certainly in the world of pain sciences, much has happened since that time. And we now know that referred pain is a central nervous system phenomenon. It is a system of what's called central sensitization, where there's an increased response of the central nervous system. And trigger points and referred pain fit modern insights of pain sciences very, very well. There are people that disagree with that, but if you look at what's currently known, trigger points really are constant sources of what's known as peripheral nociceptive input. They never quit. They continue to irritate, to give input into the central nervous system that leads to both peripheral and central sensitization. And one of the best pain scientists in the world is Lorimer Mosley, and Mosley has stated, not directly in connection to trigger points, but certainly that if you can remove a source of nociceptive input, by all means do this. And so to me, if there is central sensitization, which is a bit of a buzzword in the pain sciences now, but if people have central sensitization, which is very common, why would you not remove such a common source of nociceptive input? And with a needle, it is relatively easy to do. So to me, it makes perfect sense. When Sobel developed it, some of her ideas have shown to be not quite the way she thought they would be, because now current science has improved these things. We can now look at trigger points. Researchers at the National Institute of Health, in combination with the researchers at George Mason University in Virginia, have actually been able to visualize trigger points. We can actually see difference in size between active and latent trigger points. We can see difference in vascularization on trigger points, and they've been able to demonstrate very accurately that active trigger points, the more trigger points cause pain, the more we consider them active, that active trigger points actually have a very disturbed blood supply. What that means is that if there's limited blood supply coming to that part of the muscle, there's limited oxygen. When there's limited oxygen, the pH of the tissue drops, and has been measured by research at the NIH to be in the range of 4 to 4.5, which is far, far, far below what it should be. So again, if you look at where Travell started and where we are now, we're miles, miles beyond what Travell could ever have imagined to be happening, I think. A low pH leads immediately to the release of chemicals, leads to activation of so-called acid-sensing ion channels and transient vanillate receptors that are very sensitive to low pH, and they cause what's known as hyperalgesia. They cause central sensitization. So trigger points, the whole trigger point story must be seen from a pain science perspective. It is not just a contraction in the muscle that's kind of annoying, and if you just treat the contraction, everything will be fine. It's a much bigger, broader picture, and that makes the theoretical foundation of trigger points quite complicated today.
Right, and I think the big, big point is science. It's not just poking around the muscle, finding a sore, tender spot and putting a needle into it. There is so much science and physiology that goes into it, aside from the basic or advanced anatomy knowledge that all physical therapists should have, which is one of the big points of contention from acupuncturists. It's that so much goes into it in the respect of once that needle, once that twitch response happens, you have to have complete understanding of why you're putting a needle into the body, what you're doing, and what you expect to happen. That's why when reading through those referral patterns, if you don't study and understand exactly where a person might feel the effect of the needle going in, one, you're not doing the patient their due service, and two, you're not going to be fully treating to the capacity that the technique is possible of doing.
Correct. And these patterns of referred pain, the mechanisms of referred pain have been studied in great detail, particularly in Germany. There's a researcher named Dr. Siegfried Menzer, who has spent a significant part of his career on trying to figure out how this referred pain occurs. And it is crystal clear this happens in the dorsal horn. This happens in the central nervous system. If we look at the evidence, like how much evidence is there that this actually is a scientifically solid way to think about things? There's a paper coming out very soon. It's already will be published in the Journal of Orthopedic and Sports Physical Therapy. And for those of you who have access from the only online version of that journal, you can actually read the paper. where a couple of scientists from a university looked at what is the scientific evidence of dry needling. And these are people who, as far as I know, do not use dry needling in their practices. They really looked at it from an academic, scientific perspective. They concluded after reviewing the scientific literature on dry needling that the level of evidence for dry needling is in the highest possible category in the hierarchy of evidence-based medicine. And they graded these papers and the evidence for dry needling as 1A, which again is the highest level possible. So when Travell started doing this, it was very much an empirical art. She was an astute observer. She saw things. She mapped out these patterns and in her seminal paper in 1952. And these patterns are not always exactly what you see in every patient, but they're guidelines. They really give you an idea. The patient complains about pain down their arm. Which muscles could do that? Trigger points in which muscles could be responsible for that. And then through thorough motor analysis and sensory analysis, you come to the right trigger points, hopefully, and be able to help the patient very, very efficiently.
Well, the big reason I'm kind of harking on this is, and Joe and I have covered this in the past in our Mythbusters episode, is patients come in with all kinds of diagnoses of, you know, disc bulging, arthritis, bursitis, and it's a lot of times disc herniations in themselves are not painful. If it's not pushing on anything, they're not going to hurt aside from the initial disruption unless it's sequestered or really bad arthritis. You know, most of us start building arthritis when we're in our 20s. So they're not always the pain generators. So it's up to us to really find where they are coming from. And a lot of people have these pains that are distal to the spine, and it's always easy to blame it on a common diagnosis or an MRI or an X-ray, where it can be a lot more complicated than that. And if you really study these pathways and understand myofascial pain, if it is that, it can become not only an effective treatment technique to rid of pain, but really helps to restore function to these patients. And I know, Joe, what do you usually tell patients to explain to them when they come in and they have pain in their leg, but you know it's coming from their SI joint or their spine?
Yeah, I mean, I try to explain to them the concept of referred pain and the fact that the pain generator isn't always where they feel the painful stimuli. So it's something that is a little bit of a leap of faith on their part. But you know, as I explain, you know, how the nerves run down, you know, to that portion of the body, they tend to understand that some of their pain is generated in other places. But exciting thing is that, you know, with dry needling and with other techniques, obviously, you know, if you can break that pain cycle, I think that the patient can have a very good result. So
absolutely. Now, speaking of the pain cycle, Jan, you've been practicing for a few years, let's just say that. You're an expert in the field, and you mentioned frozen shoulder earlier. So let's pick your brain on a few common problems and the musculature that you find most commonly involved. Let's start with frozen shoulder. What muscles would you say really cause that problem? So if a young clinician, we have a few, actually we have a bunch of PT students all around the country that subscribe and listen. So if they're just out and about, even if they're not dry needling, what muscles would they start looking at that might be contributing to the problem?
Yeah, about frozen shoulders, first I think we need to recognize that most people who have a diagnosis of a frozen shoulder probably don't really have a frozen shoulder. They may have some stiffness in the joint, but that's a true frozen shoulder is actually an enormous challenge to treat. Either way, if you look at which muscles are most commonly involved with frozen shoulder, I must say the number one muscle is the subscapularis. The subscapularis is a large rotator cuff muscle, of course, between the trunk and the scapula, and very much overlooked. Most of my patients with frozen shoulder have been treated by other clinicians, and when I palpate the muscles around the shoulder, and often I start with the subscapularis, it's very commonly triggers their known pain, their familiar pain. But also if you start treating the subscapularis just by itself, We see usually an increase of 10, 20, 30 degrees of range of motion immediately. Along with the subscapularis, I would include the serratus anterior. The pectoral is minor, and probably in the first one or two, three sessions, also the lower trapezius muscle. There's a whole muscle that connects to the scapula. And in many patients, Trojan shoulder, that scapular motion is so restricted that by treating these major pulleys on the scapula, you see almost always an immediate improvement. And it was very, very quick.
That's great. I agree. I think there's a big difference between adhesive capsulitis and frozen shoulder. And most times that it's not pure adhesive capsulitis, the actual joint, the glenohumeral joint is moving fine. It's the compensation from musculature.
Yeah, I would agree with that. If a true glenohumeral problem, you can still treat those patients, but they typically, if you see them fairly acute, typically they will get worse no matter what you do. That's just a normal curve of frozen shoulder. They tend to get worse before they get better. Dry needling can take and plays a role in that, but that's certainly not the only thing you need to do. There's again, you talked about joint mobilizations before. There needs to be a well-founded rationale for how you would approach that. The nice thing, though, about something you mentioned, that there's several other diagnoses. The nice thing about trigger points is that you very often can provoke the patient's pain, because finding these trigger points, once you know how to do that, is not that difficult. Once you know how, you very commonly can provoke the pain of the patient, and then it's like, oh, it may not be as distal as they think. And my favorite is plantar fasciitis. We see many patients who come in with a diagnosis of plantar fasciitis, and when you ask them what worked, they've usually had three different kinds of orthotics. They had a night splint, and the night splint seems to work the best. And when you ask those patients, do you have any pain in your calf? I'd say 9 out of 10 deny that. They say, then look at you, little silly, like you don't know where the fascia of my plantar fasciitis is. That's in my foot, you silly. But now when you look at that, then you palpate the calf muscles, particularly the medial head of the gastrocnemius. Most of these people don't know how to jump because it is extremely painful. And that would really be the first muscle I would look at with plantar fasciitis. And that's usually a few treatments where people really get so much better. And the fact that the night splint is the one thing that they find helped, well, that's the one thing that stretches the calf muscles.
Plantar fasciitis is also one of my things I see. I see a lot of runners, and one of the things that I kind of shake my head at is I ask them, and a lot of them have had treatments, like you said. I go, well, what do you do for plantar fasciitis? And they say, well, I stretch my foot. And I kind of shake my head, and I go, well, you understand that that is one of the structures in the body that needs to be nice and taut and should not be stretched in at all. So what they're doing is they have a referral pain, like you were saying, either from the gastroc or the soleus, and they're completely stretching the wrong structure that shouldn't be stretched, and that kind of opens up a Pandora's box of other problems.
But that's true in many other parts as well. I mean, another common diagnosis that's made mostly by orthopedic surgeons, I would think, is trochanteric bursitis, you know, pain at the side of the hip. And when I ask my patients, well, how did the doctor make the diagnosis? Rarely did they get a good physical examination where people actually looked at where could this pain come from. If you have pain at the side of the hip and you say you're a runner, it has to be trochanteric bursitis. That seems to be a belief system that's in place. Yet, if you look at, for example, the vastus lateralis, or you look at the quadratus lumborum, or you look at the gluteal muscles, they all refer pain to that same region. Yes, it's very easy to confuse it with trochanteric bursitis, but once you treat the muscles, that pain goes away very quickly, and you know that it clearly is not a bursitis. Yet, almost all those patients have had multiple steroid shots in their bursa. And they define for a week or two, and then the pain comes back because that probably was not the cause of their pain. So, yeah, it is the trigger point world in that sense. The whole trigger point concept is a great differential diagnostic method as well. Okay, you have a diagnosis of bursitis. Let's see what happens when we treat these trigger points. Now, even if people would have osteoarthritis, let's say you have arthritis in your hip, then, of course, we all know that can be quite painful. There are several studies out of Denmark that have shown that even in those cases with known arthritis, which is kind of joint surfaces becomes a source of nociceptive, peripheral nociceptive input. But even in those cases, if you treat the muscle component, the peripheral nociceptive input from muscles that cross that joint, you can control the pain or manage the pain significantly better than when you just look at the joint itself.
Absolutely. I had a patient, actually, funny you mentioned that, had a congenital hip problem, and was a very high-level athlete, played lacrosse, still played lacrosse in his 30s and 40s, but he started getting very high levels of pain. He had the MRIs, he had the x-rays, had an FAI, so he had a lot of arthritis, but the arthritis only caused pain in a certain motion of the hip. But when he came to me, he could barely move that thing. So we worked, like you said, possible referrals. We worked lumbar spine, and we did dry needling, and his pain subsided about 70%. So he still had pain in that, you know, flexion internal rotation of the hip, but most of the other motions were pretty good. So there's so much to be said about compensation pain, and that kind of really builds on our previous episode that we did on runners, and we talked about hip pain and referral pain. But another thing you touched on is headaches. People get diagnosed with migraines a lot. There is so much medication use, and I'm not saying that it's not necessary always, but headaches, migraines, are not just chemical reactions. They can be very much caused from referral from certain aspects. What do you usually see with headaches, Jan?
Well, headaches, I think, are probably one of the things we see most in our clinic. And neck pain and headaches is probably the most common area of my patients. Several years ago, no one would look at muscles as a potential contributing factor to headaches. I'm always a little bit hesitant to say the trigger points are the cause of anything. I think we often confuse cause and correlation. I prefer usually to say that trigger points are correlated to these problems, and rather than being the strict cause, that'd be a little too simplistic. But if we now look at the major headache journals, such as Headache and Cephalalgia, they have published multiple scientific studies on the role of trigger points in both my migraine headaches and episodic and chronic tension type headaches. And their colleague of ours, Cesar Fernandez de la Peña, Dr. Fernandez from Spain, from Madrid, has done his first doctoral degree mostly looking at what have trigger points to do with headaches. And he has published more papers, more studies on this field than anyone else I know of. And what again comes forward again and again in all these studies that sternocleidomastoid is probably the number one muscle to cause referred pain that mimics the pain for migraine and tension type headaches. The suboccipital muscles, for example, the oblique capitis inferior muscle, now that's a somewhat tricky muscle to needle, but with good anatomy knowledge and good instruction, that is very safe to do. The upper trapezius muscle, the sphenius capitis, and these are the bigger muscles. Generally, with dry needling, I advocate starting with the larger muscles before you do very small muscles. But certainly in patients with headaches and facial pain, we need to look at the masseter, we need to look at the temporalis. We may have to look at the medial lateral pterygoid muscles as well. But these are all in the referred pain region of the larger muscles, such as the trapezius and sternocleidomastoid. So as a rule, although there are exceptions, of course, but as a rule, I prefer to look at the larger muscles first that I just listed. And if patients still have trouble, then go look at the somewhat smaller muscles as the masseter, the temporalis, and then even steps further. You can look at the procerus muscle on the bridge of the nose, and that's been shown to cause frontal headache.
John, what about tennis elbow? Can you talk to us about treatment of that?
Yep, absolutely. It's an area where there's actually a fair amount of research out of Spain again. And a different Fernandez Carrero, I believe is his name, if I remember that correctly, even top of my head, has done a fair amount of research on epicondylalgia, which or tennis elbow, and trigger points. And what they found is indeed that people with tennis elbow have many more trigger points on the involved side than people without tennis elbow. Muscles involved are often the triceps, sometimes the biceps, but also, of course, the wrist extensors, the extensor carpi longus and brevis, sometimes the digitorum, sometimes the supinatus, sometimes the anconius. So there's quite a few muscles that can do that. You can also look higher up in the shoulder. Muscles such as the infraspinatus can give symptoms of lateral epicondylalgia. Many muscles have a referred pain pattern in a C8 distribution pattern, such as the subscapularis, the pectoralis minor and major, and they can actually contribute to symptoms of medial epicondylalgia. Of interest is also, they also looked at when people have a tennis elbow, let's say on the right side, that same research group also looked at would they have more trigger points on the opposite asymptomatic side? And what they found that we indeed to be the case that people with tennis elbow on one side actually have more trigger points on the opposite side. Now, sometimes they give the explanation of it must be sensitization. It could also be potentially that their right side hurts too much and they're using the left side more, and it could just be a local overuse syndrome as well on the other side. I'm not sure that the research is quite clear on why people would have more trigger points on the opposite side from where they actually have symptoms.
That's quite interesting. And also with tennis elbow, you obviously look at the actual elbow itself. You look at the ulnohumeral joint, radiohumeral joint, you check for abducted ulna. So to elaborate on earlier conversation is there's other things to look at than just the muscle and just the trigger points. But if you're following the referral pathways, they are quite important to look at. How about a little bit more distal? If we look at, we get a lot of lumbar pain, we get a lot of glute, we get a lot of referral into the legs. What are you looking at if somebody's complaining of, let's say, referral into their leg from the low back?
Yeah, I totally agree with you that looking at trigger points by itself is not the way to go. That would be too simplistic. And people attend our courses that may look like that sometimes because we focus, of course, on teaching people how to identify and treat these trigger points. But in our clinic, we do a lot more than just treat trigger points. That's very important to emphasize. With regard to low back pain, buttock pain, even pelvic pain, I throw that in there as well, and pain down the leg. I think you need to look at, if you look specifically at trigger points, I'd say the quadratus lumborum is a big troublemaker. The lumbar multifidi are big troublemakers, but also the gluteal muscles. The obturator internus is very often involved in pelvic pain problems. And an area that's very much overlooked by many clinicians, I think, are the abdominal muscles. All abdominal muscles refer to the region of the back and the buttocks, as all the back muscles have referred pain patterns into the abdomen. But the abdomen is very important to include in that. If you take a step back and say, okay, well, that trigger point stuff is lovely and wonderful, but what about the whole picture of core stability, core stabilization? Well, I think that trigger point work supports that. And in fact, one of our course programs is a clinical anatomy course for Dr. André Fleming from the Netherlands. And in that course, we really look at stabilization. We look at the current, really very recent insights in the thoracolumbar fascia and how which muscles attach to the fascia and how they attach. And there's actually some very new, exciting findings made available in the literature in the last 2 years, just very recently. And it became clear when you look at the thoracolumbar fascia and its role in stability and the role of the common abdominal muscle tendons as it feeds into the thoracolumbar fascia, it is clear that with restrictions in mobility because of taut bands or contractures and trigger points, that the stability of the thoracolumbar fascia is immediately challenged. There's very little research on that, if any, but when we looked at the anatomy specimen in our courses, where we looked at hundreds of specimens trying to make sense of how this relates to each other, this is an area of very exciting research that I think needs to be undertaken to take a look at what is the role of trigger points in maintaining or establishing core strength and core stability. I think that is in our clinic very important, very obvious, but kind of somewhat anecdotal, of course.
Yeah, I don't think you can say enough about research. I think there's over the last decade to 5 years or so, there's been a huge push to evidence-based, and I think people get a little clouded with following clinical practice with evidence-based, and that's good to an extent, but evidence is still catching up, and you can't completely base everything on evidence coming out because then you just treat by numbers. Dry needling, and I've been looking up a lot of research-based in terms of outcomes with dry needling, and every time I look, it seems like there's more and more articles that are being published, and like you said, 1A data, 1A research, and it's not just case studies, it's actually relevant clinical research that really helps the clinician and really helps patients in the long run.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that, because in probably, I don't know how long, probably about 10, 11 years ago, Dr. David Simons invited me to join him in preparing a critical article review. It's a quarterly review paper on the myofascial trigger point literature. And I remember in these early days when I first started doing that with him, that he often would comment that my reviews were too short. He said, the publisher has given us this many papers, this many pages, and I know there's not enough research to really fill out this a lot of time paper, this amount of volume that we have, but you need to make your reviews longer because in the very near future, you will need all those pages. Well, what a prophecy that was, because the research right now is so overwhelming that actually we have exceeded our allotted page number many, many times. Because there is so much research, we can't squeeze it in, and our reviews get shorter and shorter. But yet there is so much to so much published now. Now, that does not mean that all of it is wonderful. For those of you who have ever read my review column, you will know that very commonly we are quite critical of research that's been done and that has been published. I review papers for about 18 different medical and physical therapy journals. And often because of my expertise, I get papers to review prior to publication about trigger points and other pain issues, but mostly trigger points. And unfortunately, I have to tell you that the majority of these papers are done so poorly that they get rejected. Yet a lot of other papers, of course, slip through. So not everything that's been published is wonderful. There's a lot of questionable research out there. And questionable reports and literature reviews even. So I think you need to be impressed with what trigger point dry needling can do, but at the same time, you need to be somewhat skeptical about, okay, what does the research really say? Is this really good quality research? How would you look at that, et cetera, et cetera? But again, an independent review that comes up with a 1A classification of a grade is quite encouraging and kind of substantiate the work that we started pioneering about 16 years ago.
Yeah, and we've talked a lot about the benefits of dry needling, and I'd like kind of your input as far as for PTs listening that may be interested. How should they go about getting into dry needling? How should they go about starting to learn?
The first thing I would do is make sure that you legally can do this in the state where you practice. And that is not a requirement before you can take dry needling courses. But it would kind of be sad to learn all this and then realize that you live in one of the few states where this is actually not allowed.
Yeah, you'd have to move.
You would have to move, yes. Or at least work across the state border. I mean, if you're close to the border.
Like bootlegging needles.
Yeah, but the majority, that's funny. The majority of states have approved dry needling, and some of those have been challenged. In our own state, Maryland, the Acupuncture Society and Acupuncture Board have challenged dry needling several years ago, and Physical Therapy Board is now still working on getting new regulations in place. Even this week or last week in Wisconsin, the Acupuncture Board, two acupuncture programs filed a lawsuit against the Physical Therapy Board and two other government agencies demanding that the Physical Therapy Board recognizes that dry needling is illegal in the state for physical therapists. Now, that's brand new information that just happened this week. Now, there's other states where this has been challenged. And Again, if you look at the rationale behind it, I can't escape the thought that it's a lot of turf war. So for, once you know you're in a state and the majority of states have approved dry needling, where do you go next? Well, at last time I counted, there were 15 different programs where you can study dry needling, or what better, maybe one form of dry needling. We started this discussion tonight, we're talking about all the different schools of acupuncture, and that you really can't say, well, is this acupuncture or not? That, to me, that depends on what kind of acupuncture you're talking about. Unfortunately, in the dry needling world, we're going in that same direction, that there are now, again, the last count, 15 different programs where you can learn some form of dry needling. And these programs are often quite different from each other. So I would really look at what do you want out of an education in dry needling. Do you want to learn a quick trick, is like stick some needles in and move on, or do you really want to understand the scientific basis, the evidence behind it? I'm fairly confident to say that the MyoPain Seminars program, the program that I direct, emphasizes the scientific basis the most of all programs. Our program is the longest, so therefore it's more expensive than some others. But if you can, if you, it depends on what you want out of it. If you just want to learn a trick, there's lots of small programs, short programs where you can learn a trick without necessarily knowing why you would do that or why it would work, and where you don't necessarily learn what is the mechanism of referred pain, like why would I do this? How can I explain this better to referring doctors and patients and adjusters or insurance companies? I'm pretty sure, not to sound too arrogant, but I'm pretty sure that the MyoPain Seminars program is the most extensive program you can do in the United States. Probably also the most challenging. We have two basic courses that we call the foundations courses, and I'm quite confident that after attending those two courses, you should be able to do dry needling very safely. You will not know all the intricacies of some of the more obscure or challenging muscles, so it's such as the lateral pterygoid muscle, that is a somewhat challenging muscle to treat. Some of the neck muscles, the scalene muscles, many course programs will not include those. We do this in our advanced courses. After you've attended four courses, MyoPain Seminars, you actually are invited to take a practical and theoretical exam. The practical exam is by then, for most people, not that much of a challenge, but the theoretical exam does require a fair amount of study, not just in trigger points, but also in pain sciences. We do have articles by Lorimer Mosley and by Mensi and by Clifford Wolf in our package, and we kind of push people to learn more about the broader picture of the physical therapy. Most of our students are physical therapists. But we also include a lot of information about the trigger point research, the NIH research, and other research from other parts of the world. If that's not what you want to do, well, there's lots of other choices. There's lots of other programs that teach some level of dry needling. And if I
And
would
so
have
if
to make a choice, I would look at who are the instructors, how long have they done this, have they ever published anything about this, are they active in societies that deal with trigger points. Some course programs are excellent in that. Other programs, people have never attended any meeting that focuses on trigger points. And so I would look at the qualifications. The fact that the course is accredited does not mean that it's a good course.
Right. Now, so let's say that is what we want to do. Where can they find your information, and where your classes are taking place?
Well, we have a website, myopainseminars.com, that has the entire course program in dry needling. We also have manual trigger point courses for those people who choose not to do dry needling or who are legally not allowed to do dry needling. I think that course is particularly suited for physical therapy assistants, for example, who really are not allowed to do dry needling in the States. But as a manual technique, it's a phenomenal course, and you learn all the manual techniques and the identification of trigger points. We also have several other course programs that really have not much to do with trigger points. We have to mention clinical anatomy course that's only available for our graduates of the dry needling program, so it's a bit of an exclusive program. But we also have orofacial pain courses. We actually start with a new certification program in orofacial pain in 2014. So it's not just trigger points. We also look at the pain from a much broader perspective. Again, one more comment that I promise you I'll get back to you, and I kind of forgot. There are people in physical therapy who say that, that stuff, looking at muscle pain and joint pain, is somewhat old-fashioned and outdated because pain is produced by the brain. And, that is it. That's no brain, no pain. I would agree with that. But I think you can't escape that whole notion of there is peripheral nociceptive input. I mean, Roland Stott just published a paper that looked at what are the drivers of pain in fibromyalgia, and the conclusion was muscle is the primary driver of pain in fibromyalgia. So are you interested in that kind of stuff? Now, course program, you learn a lot about it. Some other course programs, you learn nothing but a trick, and there's a whole bunch of course programs kind of in the middle of of those two, some of the extremes, if you want.
I will say one thing from my experience with your course, and I'm a skeptic by nature. So just because somebody tells
I
me,
had not noticed.
yeah, we've had some conversations. If just because somebody tells me put a needle into something, or even if somebody gives me an idea of how it works, that's still not enough for me. And what I really like is it's not just dry needling. This is not as simple as trigger points. There is so many other possibilities that you have to look at. And you're right, when you're taking a dry needling course, you learn dry needling and you learn trigger points and everything. But that's not the all of it. And the science, I think, is what everyone needs to know. If you know the science of what is going on, you have an idea of what is happening underneath the needle, and it's not just how to needle, which you can say about any technique, any course you go to. You don't have to have a high level of skill to learn a technique. Most of the PTs that are practicing are fairly smart individuals and have some kind of skill set to get through PT school, get accepted into PT school. But there's a difference between a physical therapist and a good physical therapist. And I'm pretty comfortable in saying that. And if you understand to the neurologic level, to the cell of what you're doing, then the skill and the technique will come and you'll be able to do that. Whether you're talking about joint manipulations, whether you're talking about dry needling, whether you're talking about PNF, it doesn't matter. If you don't have a full grasp of what you're doing, why you're doing it, and possible other reasons for it to be happening, then you're not going to do your patients any service. And that's what I really enjoyed about your course. Aside from, learning how to put the needle into the body, it's the in-depth background knowledge of knowing when you're putting that needle in, what is going on, and what you should expect, and how it'll affect the patient.
Gene, I appreciate that feedback. And but it, again, some of the people asked us during the courses, why do you demand so much from us? Why do we have to read all this literature? And we don't do this to make you miserable and to have to spend a lot of time, but if we want to be an evidence-informed profession, we have to take these steps. We have to be on top of the literature. We need to, and I don't expect that people will read all this. Since I review the literature, I'm kind of forced myself to read it, but that's why I take courses. And when I take courses myself, and I do take a fair amount of courses, I like to go to instructors who have done that work for me, who can digest it, who can bring it to me in almost like bite-sized format, and I can get a grasp of the literature. They give me some of the articles. I'm very happy. If I just learn a trick without any basis that would put it in a broader context, to me, it's a bit of an empty course. And I think if we want to be an evidence-based, or I prefer the term evidence-informed profession, what better way to do than to take courses and learn the evidence?
Yeah, and it's twofold. It's explaining things to your patients, but I know we speak with other professionals as well. I know I communicate with physicians regularly. We have very good, sometimes spirited conversations, and dry needling comes up quite often. And I've had a few physicians that have had bad experiences with dry needling. I've had a physician that referred to another clinician, and they dry needled without the physician knowing, and the physician's patient had a pneumothorax, and we were talking, and we had a very good in-depth conversation, and he had no problem with me needling his patients after that. Obviously, I did a few, and they gave him good feedback. But if you can't have a full grasp and understanding of what you're doing, not only shouldn't you be doing it, but you shouldn't be talking about it, because you come off. The saying is, "Don't say anything and let them think you're stupid," versus opening your mouth and proving them right. It's kind of kind of along those lines. So if we want to be the doctors that we're trained to be, and we're going to be, you know, the clinicians, open access and moving forward, then we need to have the science and the real understanding behind of everything we do.
Now, we teach these courses in many countries. I mean, this coming month, I'll be in Europe twice for courses. I'm in Ireland. I'll be in the Netherlands later this in the fall. Next month, in October, I'll be in Dubai. We teach courses in Israel, in Thailand, in South America, name it. In several of these countries, people take the exact same exam. The exam is translated into language. So we've had hundreds, if not thousands, of people taking these exams. And, well, yeah, it's a bit of work to get through the material. But interestingly, the vast majority says afterwards, it was so worth it. I am so glad I did all this. And people don't complain afterwards about the workload. They're just happy they passed the exams. And are so much enriched with so much knowledge and become such better clinicians, not just with a needle, but as better clinicians overall, because, you know, that's probably not something we do much as a profession. And if you just look at the number of PTs who have advanced degrees other than their initial DPT, but have PhD degrees, that's still a very small percentage of a field. You know, what better way to learn? And again, of course, participants prove that this is a good idea, because I'd say that 90%+ said, I'm so glad I did this.
That's completely understandable. And, you know, people complain less if you maybe have a few courses in Hawaii or, what do you think, Joe, somewhere in the Caribbean?
Caribbean's great. But, Jan, you know, hey, I'm just so glad that we got to do this talk tonight, because I think that you've provided us with a lot of good information. It really, it's interesting to me. I think that dry needling will be one of, if not the next course that I look into taking. And I really appreciate you giving us your time and helping to inform our listeners.
My pleasure.
Again, yes, thank you. Thank you for your time. If you want to find anything more about Dr. Jan Dommerhold, look into My Pain Seminars. You're also practicing, right, Jan?
Yes.
Appointments. You are in the Bethesda area.
Yeah, the name of my clinic is Bethesda Physio Care.
Bethesda Physio Care, so you can look us up. Again, follow us on Twitter. If you have any comments for Jan, go ahead and email him or us. Thank you so much for all the feedback, all the reviews. It's been great. We constantly getting more and more subscribers, so thanks for listening, especially the students. So you can follow us on LinkedIn, on any other social media sites. And again, thanks for listening. We'll see you guys next time.